You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
The online whistleblower WikiLeaks started up in 2006, and since that time, it has published documents from numerous sources. But perhaps the two most controversial leaks took place this year. In July, WikiLeaks published 92,000 documents pertaining to the war in Afghanistan. And just this month, some 390,000 classified U.S. military documents on the Iraq War were released. This last leak is the largest intelligence disclosure in U.S. history. Author and journalist Protap Chatterjee has joined me on the phone from Amsterdam to discuss this most recent collection of documents. Protap Chatterjee is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the author of Halliburton's Army. He's written about the leaked Iraq documents for The Guardian of London. Greetings, Protap, and welcome to Red Eye again.
Thanks for having me.
What exactly are these documents? Why are they called war logs?
Well, they are basically secret documents, and I say secret because they fall into one of several classifications the U.S. military has for documents that are not supposed to be disclosed to the public. And the lowest level is actually secret. The next level up is top secret, and then you have secure compartmentalized documents, which are for only, you know, specially cleared people. So this is actually the lowest level of classification. They are numerous because they're field reports. They are what are called incident reports. Every time that something happens that's out of the ordinary, such as a convoy being hit by a bomb or a soldier shooting somebody or a body being discovered, they have to report it. These aren't tactical reports. They don't tell you the plans. These aren't, you know, the Pentagon Papers. They don't tell you the strategy of Washington. They simply are perspective on everything that went right or wrong, rather everything that went that was out of the ordinary for the soldiers. It doesn't represent the Iraqi point of view. It's just soldiers. They are raw intelligence files in some ways. And so it's everything the soldiers heard, the soldiers saw in a period of 6 years, from January 1st, 2004 to December 31st, 2009. So you get a very fine, granular view of what soldiers experienced, and especially if you sort it by year, by date, by place. You get a sense of what it was like to be in their shoes. Now, some of these things they saw, and they reported it as they saw it, and perhaps in some cases these were not complete. And in some cases, I'll give you an example. There's the famous Nisour Square shooting where Blackwater opened fire and killed 17 civilians. Well, in the records it says only 9 were killed, and it's not because they tried to reduce the number of casualties, but because it was the first impression. Now, when an investigation takes place, that happens at a higher level. That might be top secret or security compartmentalized. So all we're getting is not those more detailed reports which have been filtered and corrected, but just the first things that the soldiers experience. And therefore, there are certain things missing. Let's say if there was a massacre and there were no soldiers present, you wouldn't hear of it or see it. It doesn't tell you everything that happened to the private security contractors, for example, because they're not soldiers, so they file a different set of incident reports. And finally, because this is what they heard and saw, some of what they heard, presumably what they saw was relatively accurate, but some of what they heard is not necessarily accurate. They talked a lot about the role of Iran in Iraq, and previously in the previous third logs, the role of Pakistan. Now, it may well be that both those countries, Pakistan and Iran, were quite involved in the in helping quote-unquote insurgents or militants. But all we have is the soldiers' words for it as they heard it through their translators from somebody else. This information could be inaccurate. In fact, in many cases, seems to be a little short of the mark. So again, just to conclude, this is the raw field experiences of the foot soldiers of America in Iraq over 6 years.
Now, there's always been controversy over the casualty figures, the total casualty figures of Iraqis. Do these documents improve our ability to assess the actual number of casualties there?
They do. So the U.S. government has always maintained, General Tommy Franks early on said that only, he said we don't do body counts. And now, of course, now that we look at these logs, that we realize that's not true. They did absolutely do body counts. At least they had these raw field reports that told us what had happened and what the soldiers observed. There's a nonprofit called Iraq Body Count that kept us a civilian death toll, and basically they did that by filing every media report that they saw and checking it up against at least one other independent set of reports. So maybe two different reporters or two different sources, but what they felt if they had two sources, that was confirmed. And they came to a total of about 108,000 confirmed deaths. These documents, in fact, since they were maintained by somebody else, have also come to about the same number, about 108,000. However, it's a different 108,000 because these are soldiers' reports as opposed to media reports. And Iraq Body Count has spent months collating the two and trying to see which ones overlap and which ones don't. And they've deduced that at least 15,000 civilian casualties that they had not recorded were present in these documents. About 64,000 overlapped, about 15,000 civilian casualties are new to their records. So their total now has gone up to 122,000. Plus, you add in the combatants, i.e., the American soldiers, the Blackwater contractors, the Iraqi police, the Iraqi army, Al-Qaeda, the Ba'ath Party militants, and that's another 28,000. So now we have a minimum number of 150,000 people confirmed killed by either the Pentagon or media reports. That may well be a low number. In fact, almost certainly is. The Pentagon records another 192,000 injured. A number of those would have died. Plus, there are people who died because of lack of access to health care, lack of proper nutrition. So the correct number of people who died as a result of the invasion is probably, you know, much, much greater, perhaps 500,000, maybe more. Hard to tell. But we know that 150,000 individuals died, of which 122,000 are generally agreed to be civilian.
Mm-hmm. Because I've seen interviews with Iraqi journalists that have regarded these figures as laughably low. Not laughably, but not tragically low.
They're simply a set of numbers that has been confirmed, in names of individuals that have been confirmed. Nobody's suggesting that this is the total number. This is simply the confirmed record, and it could be a lot more. Could be a little more, could be a lot more. It's hard to tell. But we know these 150,000 people have died because either the military or the media, those two sources, have documented. They're not trying to estimate, like John Hopkins did, how many might have died. They're simply confirming who has been recorded as having killed violently.
Can you give us some examples of the kind of incidents that are recorded in these documents?
Well, the documents really range. It's everything from, you know, bodies that have been found and reported to the soldiers to the victims of, let's say, roadside bombs, to people the Americans themselves shot and killed. So it's a whole variety, whatever the soldiers might have experienced. In many cases, there are dozens of cases of Americans shooting at civilians at checkpoints and killing them. There's a few cases of Blackwater and private security contractors doing that. There are also a lot of incidents of the Iraqi police imprisoning people, torturing them, beating them. There are, of course, then the victims of suicide bombings. And those are the kinds of things that are covered. Some of them are quite serious incidents where there's a case of an Apache helicopter hovering over a crowd that's trying to surrender, and the Apache crew radios back to the base and says, these men are trying to surrender, should we let them go? And they said, well, you can't. The lawyer radios back and says, no, you can't surrender to a plane, so kill him. So they shot them. And that's happened in several occasions where the soldiers themselves are a little worried, but the officers said, you issued the order to kill. So there are, and, you know, there are quite a few disturbing incidents such as these.
We spoke with you earlier this year, and you discussed the drones being used in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Do these documents provide any illumination on the use of drones?
They do, actually. There's some documentation. Again, remember, again, these are field reports by mostly ground soldiers, so we're not going to get a very detailed description, but we'll get some. There are a couple of incidents. Now, most of the drones that you hear about and that I talked about last time are the drones, the Predator drones used by the Air Force with bombs being dropped by the CIA in Pakistan. Because these aren't CIA reports, we don't know much about what they did, but we do know what the soldiers did. And in some cases, because they weren't given access to the Air Force drones, which are more sophisticated, they tried their own systems. So, for example, the Marines started out in 2004 with a small 5-pound drone called the Dragon Eye, and they would, you know, launch them, and they would hover for about an hour. But they mostly got shot down. It was quite a disaster. And you see that document in the war logs. Then the second kind is the Marines tried something out that was a little more stable. It was a bigger plane. It was about 25 pounds. But those crashed actually quite often. And there's one quite funny incident where a group of small boys picked up the plane and refused to give the parts back because, you know, they thought it was their toy. And they didn't want to give back to the soldiers who were trying to give them $50 to get it back. The third kind that was much more successful is the Warrior Alpha drone, which the Army used mostly to observe people placing bombs. And then they would follow up and shoot and kill them. There's quite a few incidents of that, and they were very proud of how successful they were. There's a U.S. Army unit called Odin, named after the god, the Norse god of war and death. But the Odin stands for observe, detect, identify, neutralize. In other words, you know, kill people. And it worked quite well in a sort of in an actual battlefield where you have people sneaking out in the middle of the day, in the middle of the night, and planting a bomb. So in that sense, it was relatively effective for the purpose of observing them and then perhaps killing them. On the other hand, in the more mundane things like weapon smuggling, etc., it seems to have been quite a failure. And I describe in my Guardian article a project called Operation Seventh Veil, in which they tried to detect weapons smuggling on the border of Syria. And each time they would come down for a closer look or send in ground support, they would find that the men were shepherds or cigarette smugglers. And it was kind of a waste. I mean, it's in general, these, you know, you could have very sophisticated drones, but and they're good if you want to, you know, go quickly to a mountain and shoot somebody or kill them. You can also observe them, but it doesn't necessarily tell you a whole lot more. I mean, you could observe somebody going in and out of a house with a gun. It doesn't mean that you plan to use it or that it's their gun or that they may have been forced to use it. So it's a fairly fallible system of surveillance, and I don't think it's been that successful except when you want to kill people. And then, you know, it can pinpoint people and you can kill them. There are much larger questions one has to ask as to if that is not extrajudicial killing. They have not been tried and they have not had an opportunity to present the other side. Certainly there is quite an interesting set of documents, a small amount, in these Iraq war logs.
Looking at the media coverage of the WikiLeaks release of these documents, what would you say might be changed or not changed in terms of popular understanding of this war, its character, and its consequences?
Well, the media coverage, I think, has been quite bad, actually, in some ways. A lot of it has focused on Julian Assange. A lot of it has focused on the fact that the suggestion that this might be treason or a problem for U.S. troops. And so even though some newspapers, like The Guardian, for whom I write a column, has done very good coverage, I think the general media particularly in the United States, has been to mock WikiLeaks. But having said that, I don't think the media coverage is as much. It has certainly changed, I think, the public perception, but of both WikiLeaks and the U.S. war in Iraq, I think the biggest change is, in fact, on the military itself. The military itself is going to have to be a lot more careful as to what it does. It realizes that anything it does that's recorded is going to be likely leaked and transmitted. So I think it will change the nature of war itself, not because of the public perception as such, but because of the threat. I mean, I think the U.S. military is running quite scared of these kinds of things. They have 120-person task force set up to follow this. You know, the Secretary of Defense, the President have weighed in. They keep saying there's nothing new here, yet it is treason. It's a very confused message. But I think it's a message of a group of people who realize that they can't, that business as usual is no longer going to be acceptable or possible.
Thank you very much for that. I've been speaking with Prothap Chatterjee. Prothap is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the author of Halliburton's Army. His articles on the leaked Iraqi war logs can be found in the Guardian newspaper of London.